Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thank you for joining us. When you are a Kentucky community with zoning laws and planning units, state law requires that you pause every 5 years to plan ahead for the next five. It's called a comprehensive plan, and it's the blueprint or the roadmap for the zoning process. Now, although many Kentucky communities have no zoning laws, for those that do, the comprehensive plan is a fundamental prerequisite. This is the year Lexington hits the refresh button. We've partnered with CivicLex, a nonprofit civic education and media organization that stays on top of the issues, policies, and the procedures that shape life in Fayette County. And we're asking them to help us track this work throughout the year. So we're joined by CivicLex founding director, Richard Young. Hello, Richard.
Hey, Tom. Nice to be here.
And first, if you would give us the basics about the comprehensive plan.
Sure. So the City of Lexington's comprehensive plan is constitutionally mandated by the state. You know, all communities in Kentucky have to have a comprehensive plan. And really what it does is set sort of long-term vision and sort of guiding principles for land use policy in a community. So in Lexington, obviously that focuses on the whole county, all of Fayette County. And the interesting thing about it, that land use might sound really, really boring, but it actually touches an enormous number of things in our everyday lives here in Lexington. And the comprehensive plan is a really important, or the upcoming update to the comprehensive plan is a really important opportunity for the public to provide their input on what they want to see happen in Lexington over the next 20 years.
Does it kind of break down into categories or themes?
It sure does. So Lexington's comprehensive plan is called Imagine Lexington. You can go and actually read it yourself at imaginelexington.com. It's pretty well organized and pretty easy to read through. And in there, you'll see that it sort of breaks down into several themes. The first one, theme A, is really focused on neighborhoods and housing and the sort of way that Lexington wants its housing to be built, the sort of scale and size and density and location. There's also the second theme is protecting the environment. So Lexington has a number of environmental priorities, in particular stormwater remediation. So policies relating to land use and the environment are in that one. There's also one for jobs and prosperity and how to how land and land use and zoning codes can be used to, incentivize the creation of well-paying jobs in Lexington. There's another theme that really focuses on making Lexington a place that people really desire to be. So that touches everything from transportation to the sort of cultural landscape of Lexington and how we sort of think about our identity. It also talks about public art. And then the last theme, two more themes, but the sort of last topical theme is really related to the sort of urban and rural balance of Lexington and Fayette County and how we hold those two things in tension and in concert with each other.
In any of these areas, do you see the potential for tensions?
Yes. Yes, I think in all of these areas, there's potential for tension. You know, there are a lot of different visions of, you know, what people want our community to look like, right? If you talk to any individual person, their perspectives on any of these issues, from what their neighborhood should have to how we utilize our sort of agrarian lands to what kind of jobs they want, that's going to be completely different from one person to the next. And so, you know, with that, there are a variety of viewpoints, a really significant number of viewpoints. And with that many viewpoints, there's a lot of tension around these issues. And, you know, if you sit in on any city council meeting or any sort of city commission meetings, you'll hear a lot of these same topics sort of come up over and over again. And that's why the comprehensive plan is just so important, right? It touches so many aspects of what Lexington looks like now and what it's going to look like into the future.
Way back in 1958, that was 64 years ago, Lexington drew a circle around itself, more or less, and established what was the nation's first urban growth boundary. And that was an attempt to prevent urban sprawl into the green spaces surrounding the city, so no city services outside of the boundary. And it's gone through a lot of revisions over the years. How closely does today's boundary resemble that original one?
You know, the boundary's changed somewhat over time. New sort of parcels and areas have gotten added in historically, but it hasn't been for almost two decades. The boundary hasn't really changed or adjusted. And, you know, there are a lot of perspectives on whether or not that boundary should expand, and if it does, what that would look like. And that's, you know, historically, and it looks likely to be in the months of ahead of us to be a central topic in the comprehensive plan.
Do you anticipate efforts to expand that boundary to enable more suburban development?
You know, I think there are a couple things with that. You know, I think that's always been part of the conversation in the comprehensive plan, and every comprehensive plan is what happens to the boundary. And, you know, I think it will probably be unsurprising if that is part of the conversation moving forward. The interesting thing is, you know, if expansion does happen, what does that look like? Does it look like what it's traditionally looked like, or does it look like something else? And, you know, I think that while the boundary obviously gets so much focus and so much attention in comprehensive plan conversations, it sort of takes a lot of the air out of the room for the rest of these issues that are really important, right? What does our environment look like, right? Like, we've noticed there's been a lot of flooding historically in Lexington because of issues with our stormwater system. How directly impacts people's lives. What are our housing choices inside the boundary, right? What types of jobs are we looking to attract here, and how do we actually incentivize those? So, you know, there are all of these things that touch all of our lives, and the boundary is an important piece of the comp plan, but it is by no means the sort of central point. There are many other issues and policies that are going to be touched in people's lives through this plan.
Well, to expand a little bit on something you just touched on, if the boundary is not expanded, yet our population continues to grow, will that put pressure on housing prices and make affordability all the more out of reach for many?
You know, I think that's a question that a lot of folks have been wrangling with, right? I don't think it's of any surprise to anyone in Lexington that housing prices are gone up. There's a housing demand study that was done a few years ago, led by the PBA's office and a variety of other organizations, that showed that, to no surprise, there's a lot of demand for housing, and there's, you know, only a limited supply. You know, there's always been this sort of, I think, tension between, do we focus on building new housing out in greenfields, or do we redevelop land already inside the city for more dense housing that can accommodate more people? And, you know, those sort of two things are held in tension often with each other. But, you know, I think there's a little bit more to it than that. And I think that the sort of conversation that's going to be happening in Fayette County over the next, you know, 5 months or so with the comprehensive plan is going to be a really interesting opportunity to dive in to this topic. Are those our only two options? What will happen if we choose one or the other? What's going to play out over the next 20 years in Lexington? And it's a challenging, complicated topic.
Well, Richard, your organization, CivicLex, is reviving its On the Table event. Tell us about that.
Sure. Yeah. So On the Table is actually a really interesting program that started in Chicago and was sort of adopted in Lexington by the Bluegrass Community Foundation. And then, you know, we sort of adopted it from them. And really what it is it's a sort of citywide conversation that happens over a series of days about any, you know, sort of specific topic that impacts our community. And when it first came to Lexington in 2017, it actually coincided with the most recent refresh of the comprehensive plan. And so the sort of table conversations, there were almost 10,000 people that participated across the city of Lexington in this conversation, was used as input for the comprehensive plan. And so we're hoping in 2022 to revive that same approach and really give anyone in Lexington a chance to either join or host their own conversation about these, you know, really critical issues like neighborhoods and the environment and jobs to inform the comprehensive plan. And we've built a great partnership with the city of Lexington to sort of take the data from those conversations and the feedback we receive from those conversations and really use them as a primary public engagement process for the comprehensive plan update.
How far along are you with this, Richard? Do you have some details now?
We sure do. Yeah. So On the Table is going to be happening in Lexington from April 10th to April 16th. And, you know, it's always a little bit, it's always a sort of a novel concept for people at first, but really what it is anytime during that week, anyone in Lexington can host a conversation in their home, over Zoom, at their school, at a library, in a park about these issues. We'll provide you with all of the materials you need to have that conversation. And as part of that, you sort of fill out a survey that then provides that information back to us. And that's really all there is to it if you want to host. If you don't want to host, if that seems like a little bit of a challenge to you, you can also attend a public conversation. So there are going to be a number of public conversations that are happening during that week that are open to anyone in the community to attend. And those will be both, over Zoom, like a lot of us have been doing for the past couple of years. But we're also hoping that a lot of those conversations are going to be able to be in person in a safe way. And you can find out information about registering to host or join a table at otplex.org.
This is going to be interesting. We'll be hearing from Richard and his team at CivicLex throughout the year as they bring us perspectives from various sides of the issues under discussion as this new comprehensive plan for Lexington is, as Richard put it, refreshed, and we're looking forward to that. Richard Young, director of CivicLex, thanks, and talk to you again very soon.
Thanks so much, Tom. Looking forward to it.
Coming up after the break.
For musicians like myself and producers and people who've spent their entire life in arts and culture, Eastern Kentucky is the holy land.
A Somerset artist on the same wavelength.
So many great musicians coming out of this area that, you know, that some are getting really big and some have been around for a very long time, and they deserve our recognition and our attention and our attentive ears.
A new event to satisfy those ears.
It is called Festival of the Muse. It is going to take place on August 26th and 27th of this year, and it will be at Hard Shells. It's in Breathitt County, Kentucky.
And the local band gets a big break.
We are super excited to finally be headed not only to great stages in Philly and in New York, but opening for the Tower of Power is just amazing.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
WEKU is supported by Hicks and Funson. Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Mitch Whitaker provide legal representation for car and truck accidents and other personal injury matters. More information at 859-777-7000.
Major support for WEKU comes from Kentucky's Touchtone Energy Cooperatives, supplying reliable power to co-op members and helping local residents through Co-op Connections, a benefit partnership between local health services and the cooperative that connects members with dental, vision, and other benefits. More at connections.coop.
Eastern Standard continues with Tom Martin.
Earlier in the year, for his series Depth of Field, Dwayne Lundy talked with Ian Thornton, Tyler Childers manager and the founder of the Huntington Music and Arts Festival. To set the stage for what's ahead in this segment, here's a clip from their conversation.
The fact that we come from this Appalachian region where nobody thought, this isn't Seattle or L.A. or New York. We're Appalachia. And, oh, y'all play hillbilly music? No, we have everything. Come to find out. And that was kind of my driving force, is like that underdog kind of mentality. You know, look down on us if you want, but watch watch what we do.
Oh, I think the geography inevitably over the years, which was once apparel, has actually been a benefit, at least from my point of view.
It really has. It really has. And that's the thing, like, because people, like the music scenes that I came up in, people are so supportive of each other. It's not like a dog fight. You know, it's not like people are like going after each other or whatever. Everybody goes, regardless of genre or whatever it is, you're supportive of your scene. They're going to shows. They're going and like checking out these bands. And that's something to behold. And maybe it's some smaller towns or whatever it is, but it's a really special thing.
The past few years have seen several Kentucky artists break into the national music scene, including on Saturday Night Live.
Ladies and gentlemen, Sturgill Simpson.
Earning a huge, prolonged standing ovation after performing with Sturgill Simpson at Rupp Arena, Tyler Childers. Chris Stapleton on 60 Minutes.
You can't possibly know how everybody's going to feel about a song that you write. That's impossible to know. I don't trust computer research or phone surveys or anything like that. You have to take it to the people. I trust people.
An op-ed by the founder of Louisville's Forecastle Festival, J.K. McKnight, recently appeared in the Lexington Herald Leader calling on Eastern Kentucky to pay close and serious attention to what's happening in its music scene. Welcome to Eastern Standard, J.K.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
In that op-ed, J.K., you wrote about the sold-out show at Rupp Arena performed by Eastern Kentucky natives Sturgill Simpson and Tyler Childers, and how you felt that this show had the potential to be a defining moment for Eastern Kentucky. Tell us more. What came to mind?
Absolutely. Well, I think what came to my mind immediately was just the accumulation of so much incredible talent in a region that, you know, for a lot of people in Kentucky, you know, it doesn't always come. A lot of times it comes front of mind for reasons that it shouldn't come front of mind. And for musicians like myself and producers and people who've spent their entire life in arts and culture, I mean, Eastern Kentucky is the holy land. I mean, it's the Mecca. It's something that I've revered. I've been working in that region for 10 years with businesses and nonprofits and organizations. And, you know, I think when that show came, it was just, to me, it was a bubbling up. It was accumulation of so many incredible artists from so many generations that finally kind of got their moment, I felt like, in, you know, really in the spotlight that's always been deserving of it. And, you know, people don't always think of traditional music as a world music, as a global music, but it is. And it's arguably more influential now than it ever has been. So to see that, you know, see that sold out arena tour and to see the attention it was getting and the publicity it was getting, it definitely made me, just really content to see that happen, but more excited to see what was going to happen next. And that's, I think, where I got involved in helping put together this report on culture and cultural economics in the region.
Well, first, she wanted to know how we convince a culture that often associates self-worth with personal work ethic that art is both a legitimate career and can actually lead to a sustainable income. And I'm wondering if the answer to that question is in the data that you gathered for a cultural economic analysis of Eastern Kentucky. You mentioned it in the op-ed. Tell us what that study reveals.
Yeah, I think it could be. I mean, the key is cultural infrastructure, you know, and cultural access. You know, I think those are two of the keys that I found in this report that's lacking in a lot of, not just Eastern Kentucky, but a lot of rural communities across the country. There's the talent is there. The talent's always been there. The ground has always been very fertile for artists that really, I feel like, are taking old-time music, music that goes back really since the settling of our state and taking it to whole new places, and then that's being adopted by contemporary musicians everywhere. But really what's been lacking, you know, I think is that opportunity. And to need, you know, for a young musician to get that opportunity, you know, there's got to be investment in the communities, in infrastructure and in access. And when you get those kind of things coupled with deep industry knowledge from some folks on the outside, I think it's kind of that combination that can really move the needle. But the good thing is, I mean, again, the talent is there and always has been there. It's just been, how do we turn the flywheel further, you know, to give these musicians a bigger platform to be expressed on?
Your study focused on my hometown, Moorhead in Rowan County. What did you find there?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think one thing it revealed about Moorhead was just the incredible amount of people that are already involved in the music industry there. I mean, it was over 5%. I believe an economic impact of 520 jobs and an output of $38 million. And, you know, when you look at that per capita, you know, at 5.12%, that contribution to the music economy there is larger than New York City and you know, Austin, Texas, and a lot of other places too. So, and I think something else too is just not only do we find that the entertainment industry and music had such a big component of the total jobs, but also just the industries. I mean, I'm looking at it right now in the music ecosystem, and that industry is up there with construction. It's up there above public administration. It's above, it's way above finance and insurance and agriculture and forestry and real estate. And it's almost to what accommodations and food services is. And that was one of those data points that we didn't expect to see. You know, no. We thought it would be much further down the line there. No, it's right there up in the middle. So that's something that's very unique. That's a Moorhead and in the county, and, you know, puts it in a fraternity of what we call music cities out there that that everyone recognizes. So the question, because, you know, how do we work and facilitate, you know, more opportunity for more musicians there to be seen and heard?
Way to go, Moorhead.
Yeah. And I'll say one other thing I'll say about Moorhead too is, you know, it also just being someone who's produced festivals, you know, and really helped here in Louisville with creating Forecastle and everything that's done to drive music industry and arts and entertainment and culture here. Yeah, there's certain keys that Moorhead has that I think is unique. You know, I think the university obviously being there, what you're seeing with job growth and business, with App Harvest being there, you know, all those things kind of go together and I think really, you know, make that ground even more fertile for arts and entertainment and opportunity. So it's really exciting to see all those fostering up.
Well, after decades, generations really, of negative portrayals of life in Eastern Kentucky, there's a very understandable and very real sense of insecurity about stepping into the national limelight with artistic expression that's culturally authentic. Our friend Crystal Jones suggests that, as she put it, there's a deep conversation to be had about the legitimacy of the art itself and whether or not others will be interested in seeing and hearing it. Are Tyler Childers, Sturgill Simpson, and Chris Stapleton, who's just been on 60 Minutes, are they out there paving the way, proving that the art is being heard and appreciated?
I think so. And I think what they're proving, too, is that, again, it's a global music. You know, the music that is native to Eastern Kentucky is a global music, and it's more popular now than it ever has been before. And, you know, that's why when I'm looking at this data and I'm looking at, you know, for example, you know, music ecosystem output per capita, I'm not surprised that I'm looking at this and I see Moorhead and I see Brown County up there with Seattle, Washington, you know, Asheville, North Carolina, New Orleans, Austin, Texas, Tulsa, which is a really booming market right now. I'm not surprised that I see that. And I think, you know, the whole point of the op-ed I wrote and what we've been talking about is there's more opportunity like that. There's more artists, you know, in that area that are working their way up. And if we can all focus on it and help create the right platforms and the infrastructure and the access for those artists to be able to continue that upward climb and the momentum that they have, you know, I think we're going to see a lot more Sturgills and Tylers and Chris Stapletons. They're there, you know, they're there. They're just looking for the opportunity. And, you know, coming from a city, you know, in Louisville, you know, we tend to take for granted the platforms that are available here and the infrastructure and the network and the industry that exists in urban communities that doesn't always exist as much in the rural communities. But the talent is there, and I would argue even the talent is greater in a lot of these communities. So it's, you know, it's really, it was an incredible study to do this and be part of it and really, again, kind of understand the mathematical equation, you know, the data side of it, just like we always knew in our hearts, the emotional side of it.
You mentioned infrastructure. I'm just wondering if we could kind of expand on that for a minute. What exactly would that be that is needed to make this happen?
Absolutely. I mean, it starts with venues. I think it also goes to recording studios. And mm-hmm. then it goes to hospitality infrastructure. You know, if you're bringing in, you know, national artists to these communities, you know, you need to have hotels. You know, you need to be able to have certain hospitality conveniences and amenities to be able to track those artists. So I think those are two. I mean, festivals, again, one, I think require specific infrastructure within the built environment to be successful. It can't just be a piece of land. It has to have access to it. It has to be able to build an electrical grid in it. A lot of people think that we can just, you know, go out in a field somewhere and, you know, create a festival, and it doesn't really work like that. So I think those are all things. You know, we think of restaurants, think of lodging, we think of service providers. You know, there's got to be service providers that can access that as well. If you're, you know, if you're talking about a festival, you can, there's everything from, you know, people providing portalets to concessions to distributors to stagehands to, I mean, a whole array of needs. So, you know, I think those are all kind of things that go into it.
After you've created a festival, and you certainly have, how do you stick to the original intention of the festival? In this case, of course, it would be to elevate and showcase the music of Eastern Kentucky, while you have enormous entities like Live Nation circling around and looking to take it over. How do you resist that?
Yeah, well, I think we're probably over the time of festival acquisitions. I think that peaked in the 2010s. But yeah, the answer is that it's an evolution. You know, festivals evolve with the audience. You have festivals, of course, like my friend runs Newport Folk Festival, Jay Sweet, and you know, and you think of Jazz Fest too, and festivals that have focused on the breadth and the width of the artistic genre in which they're representing. So I think, but even those festivals too, where they stay true to the genres that they're in, those genres evolve over time. So I think all festivals are doing that. I mean, festivals, we always say, you know, music is the ultimate here and now medium and, you know, ultimate kind of catalyst for relevance, because it is, it's a snapshot of pop culture. So from my experience in doing festivals, you're constantly evolving with the audience, but also staying true to a core brand. When we started Forecastle, I mean, it was, you know, it's music, art, activism, you know, and those are still three of the core pillars of the festival, even though the music genres have evolved and the audience has grown up and also got younger. But, you know, we still have a global environmental foundation that's done incredible work all over the country and a lot of work in Eastern Kentucky, working with Kentucky Natural Lands Trust and the Nature Conservancy.
Well, given what you've found out about Eastern Kentucky, what you know about it and what you're telling us about it, what is next? What do you think next has to happen to advance it all?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think we're kind of figuring that out now. But I think, you know, one of the first things that happens is alignment, you know, as you have stakeholders that aren't from the outside, but are from the inside and that they want this to happen, you know, as much as passionate music fans like myself want it to happen. So I think it's getting a structure. Sometimes we call it a chamber of culture, you know, established in Eastern Kentucky and really focusing on it as a major economic development driver, you know, because that's what it is. I mean, you know, people, when I started Forecastle 20 years ago, no one looked at festivals. You know, they looked at them as pure entertainment value. They had no idea that they had the opportunity to completely rebrand a city and, you know, bring young people in and retain talent, attract new talent. All the things you see companies struggling with today, well, you know, culture is the other half of the economic development coin. You can't ignore it. You know, if you ignore it, your town, your city is going to lose, you know, its most promising people. They're going to leave. They're not going to come back. And I think that's what we want to shift. I think that's, you know, that's a big motivating factor for me. And, you know, I'm seeing the same issues that, you know, it's systemic, I think, in rural communities across the country. They have incredible talent, but there hasn't been the cultural investment. There hasn't been the investment in access and infrastructure and these platforms, you know, to really be able to expand and expound upon the talent that's there. And this report, I think, was, you know, it's the first of its kind for Eastern Kentucky. But my hope, going back to your question, is that this could create a model, you know, and not just for Eastern Kentucky, but communities all across the country. You know, I think everyone's singing the same hymn right now with this. And what we've needed is solutions.
Well, J.K., I have to say that your op-ed struck me as a note of hope in a time when that's something we certainly could use. We could use that on a good day prior to the pandemic and everything that's happened, but now especially. So,
100%, 100%. Yeah, there's a great, I was watching this show on HBO Max recently called Station 11, which is set in a post-apocalyptic world, but it's not focused on the apocalypse. It's focused on human connection and culture being that connective tissue between people. It's really incredible. If you strip everything away, you know, if you strip all of our modern day conveniences away, you can still have arts and culture, you know, and that can still be what brings joy to people, even in the most desperate times.
All right. That's J.K. McKnight, founder of Art of Impact, the Forecastle Festival, and the Forecastle Foundation in Louisville. Thank you so much, J.K.
Thank you.
One music entrepreneur who's been working on that infrastructure that J.K. McKnight talked about is Eastern Standard contributor Crystal Jones, and she's here to tell us about a big event she has in the works for this summer. Hi, Crystal.
Hi, Tom. How are you today?
I'm good. And like I said, you've been working really hard to create a new music festival in Eastern Kentucky. First, what's it called, where is it, and when is it happening?
It is called Festival of the Muse. It is going to take place on August 26th and 27th of this year, and it will be at Hardshells. It's in Breathitt County, Kentucky.
Okay, and we'll come back to that location in just a few minutes to help people get there. But first, tell us about the artists that you've booked.
We have looked to book a variety of music because I think that East Kentucky has a vast different number of genres that are available. So we have everything from folk music to rock music. A couple of the artists, we have just a few, is James Overby, Brett Dunn and Brett Higgins, Shelby Lore. We have Laid Back Country Picker and Honey as well. So quite a variety there of different genres and different artists that are represented in the Kentucky music scene.
So as J.K. McKnight suggested in the earlier interview, musicians in Eastern Kentucky need a stage, a showcase. Is providing that opportunity your ultimate aim?
Yeah, I think it is. I think the overall aim of Muse is to provide a resource for local artists. It's also to amuse and inspire other people, and that's what we plan to keep trying to do, both with MuseFest and through the podcast as well, by introducing people to different musicians each week, letting them know who's out there and where they can find them currently on the local scene, where they can see them live, and how they can purchase their music directly from the artist to support them in that way.
Well, thinking about the region in general and its search for a new identity as we kind of move on from coal, why do you think the region needs this kind of event?
I think the festival's something that they give to the region. Like Festival of the Muse, the purpose of it, again, is to provide like a centralized event where you can experience a vast amount of artists over just a few days in an environment that's set up just for listening. It's kind of catered to that, focused on the artist. And in particular, Muse likes to focus on the process of the artist. Again, as we said, to both amuse and inspire people who listen or attend as fans or as musicians even. And I'm hoping that the festival will give people an opportunity to see the artist as individuals, because a lot of these people, their day job is as a bus driver or someone who works in a restaurant or something like that. And the infrastructure that they need to be able to manage and organize their time and the business side of this just isn't presently there. We have a lot of great venues and we have a lot of festivals, but I think what they really need is someone to help them with booking, someone to organize the venues, organize the information on both ends for the artists and the venues, and for people to help with promotion of the artist, because in the music industry, promotion is just as important as the music itself, I think. And so having the infrastructure to get all that together for the artist on behalf of the people who are creating would give them much more time to focus on the art itself. And I think economically that would be beneficial to us, because as I said, a lot of these people, they're 9-to-5ers. They're your typical essential workers. But art is just as essential to the culture, to the community, and to these individuals. So if you give them a resource and sort of a way to maybe do both, but possibly be able to make art a full-time job, I think that would be very lucrative for us both economically and artistically in the region.
So, Crystal, tell us more about the actual venue itself. What's it like? Is there a place to stay overnight?
Yeah, we're going to have primitive camping on site. Hardshell, Kentucky is actually my family farm. It's been in our family for quite a long time. It's a beautiful setting. It's kind of nestled in a large hay field. There's beautiful green trees and the greenery of East Kentucky surrounding you. There's a troublesome creek flows through the area. So it's very scenic, very laid back, very East Kentucky representative as a whole. And there is lots of places to stay. There will be lots of places to stay. We're compiling a directory of RV parks and B&Bs and hotels and motels and so forth. And that information will be available as time goes on. Between now and August, they can follow us on Facebook at Amuse in the Mountains to keep up with the event and keep up with all the information, such as the directories of where to stay, where to eat, and things like that. Things that you can see coming and going to and from the festival, as well as being at the festival itself.
Okay, and am I right that this is about 15 miles from Jackson?
It is. It's about 15 miles outside of Jackson. We're about 16 miles from the University of Kentucky Elk View Project, which is something else you can check out. And we're about 15 minutes from the UK Robinson Forest, the property that we'll be on actually butts up against that. So it's a very beautiful location.
All right, that's Crystal Jones, founder and organizer of the Festival of the Muse, happening August 26th and 27th in Breathitt County near Jackson, on Route 15, I believe. Is that correct?
That is, yeah, on Highway 476. Yep, there'll be information and directions to come with the other information for the festival.
All right, great. Thanks and good luck with this, Crystal.
Thank you for having me, Tom. And I want to encourage everyone to go support the local artists and see a live show.
Another Kentucky artist is about to step up to a national stage, and for those of us who consider Tower of Power among the funkiest in-the-pocket bands on this planet, this is especially thrilling. Joining us from Lexington, Jocelyn Hampton, lead singer for Jocelyn and the Sweet Compression. Hey, Jocelyn, welcome and congratulations. I know that in the local band world, this is a huge deal.
It is, and I'm super excited. Thank you so much.
So in mid-March, you're going to be opening for Tower of Power in Philly and New York. How did this happen? How did it come about?
Our new booking agency, RAG, Royal Artists Group, they've gotten us in contact with the Tower of Power, and they made that happen. And we are super excited to finally be headed not only to great stages in Philly and in New York, but opening for the Tower of Power is just amazing. And it's going to finally start our trajectory over to the Northeast because we haven't been yet. So this is going to be awesome.
Well, how'd the band react when they got the word?
Oh, the horns are just...
I'll bet.
The horns, there are no words, okay, for how excited the horn section got. Like, I think we found out when we were on tour in Florida, and literally the whole ride, we were listening to Tower of Power because they were just so ecstatic about it. We're all very excited, though. But they took the cake. You know, the horn section is like past the moon at this point.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the Keswick Theater in Philadelphia is downright historic. It opened in 1928, I think on Christmas night. Nationally recognized as the most comfortable, acoustically perfect listening room in the entire Philadelphia market, Sony Hall and Times Square, also a historic space. The thought of performing on these stages must be pretty exciting.
It is. It's beyond. And I'm so, you know, just grateful and honored because not too many people get the opportunity to have the shows there when you're, you know, you start out where you start out. We start out here in Lexington. And, of course, you know, we never know where how far we're going to go. We hope to go far. But for these to be our very first shows in these markets, that is almost unheard of, you know. So this is we're just extremely blessed and extremely grateful and extremely excited. I don't know how many times I'm going to say excited.
That's okay.
It sums it up.
Well, you know, one of the things we hate to hear as working musicians is somebody asking us to play for the exposure. Mm-hmm. But sometimes it can be all about exposure. And I wonder, you know, you mentioned that this is your opportunity to kind of break into the Northeast market. Do you hope that these performances in these venues might fall on the ears of people who can make that difference?
Absolutely, we do. We hope to get a new fan base there. You know, we're unheard of out there. I think being in front of such a powerful group and well-known group as Tower of Power, that will totally help us make waves in that area, hopefully, because we are so similarly, you know, we're in the same neighborhood of music.
Uh-huh.
And that also helps because a lot of the times we're opening for country artists or folk or, you know, something that's totally not even in our neighborhood at all. But, you know, it's all worked out for us so far. So it's for us to be able to open up for people who are actually in the ballpark of what we do, that makes it even more likely for their group of people who come to see them to also Google what we do.
Well, let's talk about that in the context of the show, the evening. What is it, what do you consider to be the job of the opening act for a big name international band like Tower of Power?
I think our job is to warm up the crowd, you know? I mean, not only do we get up there, do everything that we love, and try to get the crowd completely ready for what they're about to experience and what they already know they're about to experience. But some people come to hear the opening and to learn something new, to find something else that, you know, might spark their interest. So we're hoping, I mean, our job, I feel like, is to totally get them ready for the show, get them hyped up, wake them up, get them on their feet, ready to, you know, completely enjoy the show coming after us. But we also, like I said prior, hope to spark their interest as well. And maybe they'll find something else that they're really interested in.
So, Jocelyn, just to give our listeners a sense of what they would hear if they were sitting in one of those audiences, let's roll a verse of a song that'll be on your playlist. What would you like for us to play?
Yeah, let's listen to Love on the Double.
One, two, three, love.
That's Jocelyn and the Sweet Compression. They're going to be opening for Tower of Power in New York and Philly coming up soon. Jocelyn's on the line with us. And so, Jocelyn, my understanding of what the headliner's management, so in this case, Tower of Power's management, looks for when choosing an opening artist includes your social media following, maybe your monthly listeners on Spotify, your level of self-promotion, your professionalism, but also your music. Has to meet a high threshold of quality. So for that alone, congratulations. I know you all have been working toward this for quite a while.
Yes, thank you.
So can we pencil in a follow-up to hear how things went?
Oh, sure, absolutely.
All right.
Absolutely.
That's Jocelyn Hampton, lead singer for Jocelyn and the Sweet Compression out of Lexington. They'll be opening for Tower of Power on March 13th at Keswick Theater in Philadelphia and then at Sony Hall in New York the next couple of days, the 14th and 15th. Thank you so much, Jocelyn.
Thank you for having me.
Our next guest just made it to the top three in the APEs, the Appalachian Arts and Entertainment Awards, in the categories Best EP, Best Songwriter, Best Americana, and Best Male Vocalist. Yovani Pino is one of those up-and-comers that Ian Thornton and J.K. McKnight talked about. Yovani is a singer-songwriter in Somerset, and he's out with his first collection of recordings, and he'll join us in a moment. But first, to set the stage, let's listen to a clip of his music. Yovani Pino, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Hey, it's good to be here.
So tell us about your music. When somebody asks you, what kind of music do you play, what do you tell them?
For the most part, I tell Americana just because it's so easy to explain. But, I mean, if I had to dive just a little bit deeper there, it's, you know, if you think of Elvis back in the day, you know, when he gained a little weight and couldn't stop eating peanut butter and banana sandwiches, it's kind of a little bit like that. Kind of what you would have coming out of him, and mostly me trying to do an impression of Kurt Cobain's cat. So,
how did music come into your life, especially as a songwriter and creating your own music?
I've always had music in my life. I mean, my mom would sing to me, and we would create silly, funny songs. And of course, once I entered in high school, I just wanted to impress the girls and learned how to play guitar, and it kind of just went from there.
And so that's your instrument of choice, guitar, right?
Yes. Yeah. Well, anything with strings, that's kind of how my addiction started to strings was guitar. That was my gateway drug, I guess.
Although I did see a video of you, and I think you had a kick drum going on too.
I play a kick drum with my feet as well as a tambourine, and it kind of makes for a little bit more noise, and people seem to pay more attention.
What's that like for you to get up in front of a crowd and perform?
It's great. It's my therapy for the most part, and it's a lot cheaper than therapy. And when I do the whole suitcase routine, it burns a lot of calories, and it's a lot cheaper than a gym membership.
Well, when you hear people like Ian Thornton and J.K. McKnight talking about doing what they can and what we can to lift up the Eastern Kentucky music scene, how do you react to that? What do you think? Are they onto something?
I really think they are, and both of those guys are great, and they know what they're talking about, and they've been putting in the work for so many years. And I think they're absolutely correct. I think there's just a smorgasbord of so many great musicians coming out of this area that, you know, that some are getting really big, and some have been around for a very long time, and they deserve our recognition and our attention and our attentive ears.
All right, Yovani, we're going to go out with a verse from another of your songs. What should we play, and what's it about?
I think rock and roll would probably be the best example, just because it's a song about traveling and about getting out there and playing as many places and grinding your teeth as much as you can and hoping for the best, having fun along the way, and if something happens, let it be.
As Somerset singer-songwriter Yovani Pino, thanks and good luck, Yovani.
Thank you for having me.
Guess rock and roll, cause it bounces my head and it kills my soul. Ain't got no place that I can call my own, but Lord, don't you know I'm just good old broke. Get to the show and know the whiskey need and chase it down with all these broken dreams. It's just a small price.
And one more thing before we go. Apple Shop's June Apple Records just released Hobe, a new album by Ashland native Matthew Stallard. This is one of the tracks from it. It's titled Redbird. Let's listen to another, Stack of Lee. Matthew's father, Chester Stallard, was a barber over 50 years, and it was in his dad's barbershop where Matthew soaked up old-time Appalachian music from the local Kentucky traditional musicians among the regulars. Matthew went on to college on scholarships and holds a Ph.D., now retired from academia. Dr. Stallard was a professor of English at Ohio University for 18 years. That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, producing engineer and audio editor, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. You can find us online at weku.org or esweku.org, on the WEKU mobile app, and on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. Would you like to suggest a topic? Drop us a line at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.